μείνει η ακόματα! Η ακόματα χείρα μείνε! Για! Η ακόματα! Αταράρουμ!
This is Our Numinous Nature, and I'm your host, Philippe. We'll be hearing the profound stories of people with a deep connection to the natural world, from herbalists to hunters, wildlife rehabilitators to trappers, artists to homesteaders. The list goes on. My hope is to thread a needle that weaves together the many nature-related passions through stories of reverence. In nature, I've found meaning, a richness for life that grows with each new day. Maybe you feel the same. Or maybe you long to. Well, guess what? If you have been listening to the podcast late last year, you know that I was doing a series of episodes with guests in Scandinavia, and I had mailed a headphone and a microphone for audio quality. And I sent it all the way to Sweden and had two guests there. And then the next guest was going to be in Norway and the gear disappeared. Well, after 2.5 months, the gear got from Norway, sorry, it got from Sweden to Norway for today's episode, which I am really excited about. So we are going to be hearing from Sissel Morken Guillard.
My name is Sissel Morken Gullor, and Sissel is my first name. Morken is the last name I was born with, my maiden name, and Gullor is what my husband's name is. So,
she is a musician, and she works and performs in many different genres, but what we're focused on today's episode is the traditional horns of the region, as well as the herd calling and of the milkmaids, which I think is best known as kulning. But she says in Norway, they have their own words, which I believe is huling. Hopefully I'm pronouncing those somewhat close. And that's the herd calling. It's very unique. You're going to hear all about it. And her work has even been featured on Disney's Frozen with her playing the bugelhorn. If you want to check her music out, I got links in the show notes, but just go on Spotify, just go on Apple and type in her full name. And of course, every song on today's episode is her music, except for one instance where I play an archival song, which is off of a folk album. And I've got that link in the show note too. I've also put in some reference images to different things that we talk about. So we talk about the romantic paintings of Hans Dahl. I put in one of those. When we're talking about the folk art inside of her Summer Mountain Farm, I think that's actually called rose mailing. I put in some examples of that because it's incredibly beautiful and inspiring if you're interested in kind of like maybe painting the interior of your house with decorative kind of scroll worky type stuff. I also put an image of the bunad, which we talk about at the end of the episode. Bunad is the traditional clothing of the 17 and 1800s of Norway, which people still wear today on special occasions. And when we're talking about the instruments, the bugelhorn and the lur, I put in a picture of a woman in bunad playing the lur, which is a long wooden horn. We're going to hear about all this on today's episode, mainly about the bugelhorn, the lure, and we even get into some regional folklore, which you know I love. We talk about the huldr. The way she pronounces it is huldra, which is a forest nymph. Now, I want to say thank you to everyone who's been helping on Patreon. Because of you, I was able to afford sending a microphone to Scandinavia. And I'm going to save up a few of your patronage for a few months and maybe go on a little trip somewhere within driving distance and record some episodes somewhere. So we'll figure it out. But anyways, I want to say a big thank you to all of you, starting with Kendall Wine, the coon hunter over in Virginia, Ash Barron, Rachel Hawkshaw of Topsy Farms, part of Practical Homestead Economics in Ontario, Canada. They do a bunch of workshops on learning how to do stuff around the homestead. Check that out on Instagram if you want to learn some food making tips. Alexander Kurashev, a Russian Laika breeder. On Stanley, formerly of the Metaphysical Store Pyramid, Metaphysical Shop. Kaylee Lindman, Craig Koering, Diana Gonzalez, Earl C. Suter, our caving buddy, Eugene Elliott, Franklin Renshaw, Heron O'Brien, Jacob Griffin, the Houndsman, Jamie Nudd, my old film school buddy, James Mann, Jeff McLaughlin, the musician, Jez Padgett, Kenneth Giles, Leslie Peterson-Cohen, Michael Zorn, Michelle Alderson, Michelle Miller, Nathan Griffin, another Houndsman, Ryan Arnold, artist and antiquer, Rambler, Ryan Gweckner, Sophie McVicker, T. Pierce, Militant Hippie, Tristan Harper, Tyler Lively, Waddle and Dob Craftsman, and the Working Class Woodsman, and everyone at the lower tiers, thank you very much. So for today's reading, I'm going to be reading folk tales, and they're from a book called Folk Tales of Norway, edited by Ryder Christensen and translated by Pat Shaw Irvinson. I'm going to be reading three little folk tales, the first of which is about the milkmaids. All of these are about the Huldr and the Huldra folk, which you'll hear later on in this episode are kind of like the fairy people. And the Huldra is this forest nymph. And I'm going to read two of those in the intro. And then later on, when Sissel is telling her own story, I read a third. And the first one takes place with milkmaids, and the other two take place, they happen to hunters, which I just think that I love when hunters appear in folklore. And I feel very passionately that the hunting culture that we live in today, it doesn't seem to have any interest in the archetype of the hunter, how hunters have appeared in mythology, folklore, fairy tales. You know, these old stories, they're completely packed with hunters as the main character. So I just love that. And I kind of, that's part of what I want to do with this podcast, is bring some of these old tales forward and the old archetype of the hunter. Now, another word that I need to define for everybody that I certainly was not aware of is this word setter. Sissel seems to pronounce it satra, and it's S-E-T-E-R in English, at least. And that means a pasture. The first definition is a pasture high in the mountains of Norway or northern Sweden, where herds are kept in summer and butter and cheese are made. The second definition is a hut built on a satra as a shelter for the dairymaids and equipment. When Sissel defines it on the podcast, she just says the summer mountain farm. So it seems as though it defines both the farmland, the meadow, but also the actual house. So it kind of interchanges in these folk tales. Out in Begnadalen, there were some girls from Holmern and Strom who were at the Satra, the mountain farm, in the autumn. One Saturday evening, they had visitors, and they had fun and carried on until far into the night. The next morning, the dairymaids overslept. All at once, a Huldr was standing outside on a hill they called Huldr Mound. She looked down at the Satra and shouted, "Lazy bones, get up now and milk your cows. Mine are grazing, one and all, yours are standing in the stall. The sun his midday watch is keeping, and still you lie there, soundly sleeping." A grown lad from Sistrand spent a winter snaring grouse up at the Satra in the parish. He had a dog with him. One evening, as he was sitting by the hearth cooking his food, he heard something rattling outside against the wall. It sounded as if someone was leaning something against the wall. The Satra was made of stone and had a turf roof. Shortly after, someone came in the entryway and knocked at the door. The dog barked and its hair stood on end, and then in came a beautiful maiden. The boy had never seen so beautiful a maiden before. She was wearing a red bodice and a blue shirt, and she had long, fair hair which hung down her back. The boy was quite amazed that a girl would come to the Sātra in the middle of the winter. It was 7 miles to the town, and the snow was deep. She started talking to him and asked if he did not think it was lonely to stay up at the Sātra in the middle of the winter. She laughed and talked, turning and twisting and showing off to him. He answered back, laughing and joking, and thought this was really fine. At last he asked if she would stay there. Then it would not be so lonely anymore. A strange expression came over her face and she turned away from him, and then the boy saw that she had a long tail which hung below her skirt. Now he understood that she was a Huldr, and that she wanted to marry him. He had heard that Huldra folk liked to marry Christians. He became afraid of her and thought he better watch his step here, for he was halfway engaged to a girl down in the parish. When she turned around, he did not join in the joking any longer. She went on talking and laughing as before and asked if he did not like girls, but he did not say much to that. After a while, he found some pretext for going outside, and the dog went with him. The moon was full and was shining brightly. Then he caught sight of the Huldr's skis, which she had leaned up against the wall of the Sātra. They were made of brass and gleamed and shone in the moonlight. He put them on and took her poles and set down the mountain toward the parish. The ski slid over the snow unusually fast, and he went at such a speed that the dog could not keep up with him. When the boy did not come back in again, the Huldr grew suspicious and went outside to look. She soon caught sight of him heading down the mountain at a good clip. When she looked for her skis, she found that he had taken them. Then she became furious because he had wanted to run away from her. She put on his skis and took his poles and set out after him. But they were only poor fir skis with willow bindings, so they went much slower than her own. She did not catch up with the boy, but she did catch up with the dog and broke its back with the ski pole. But the boy got home, and the brass skis are still supposed to be at Henya Farm to this very day.
And I live in Biri at a farm, not very far from Lillehammer. It's in the eastern part of Norway. And the house I live in is from the 1830. So it's quite old buildings around here. And when I look outside now, it's almost all white because we still have a lot of snow. But I'm very looking forward to spring.
Sure. And it sounds like it's much colder where you are than where I am. But I think many people here are waiting for spring to come too.
Yeah.
Now, can you describe the landscape a little bit? Are you in a fjord? Are there, you know, large mountains around, or what's it look like out there?
Yes. It's not a fjord where I live, but we have the biggest lake in Norway. Here it's called Mjøsa. So it's the closest to the coast that we could be, a part of, well, it's wrong to say that because we are the furthest away from the coast, but we have a kind of a small sea here. It's a big lake, and I don't live far from the really high mountains, but I have to travel like an hour or hour and a half to get there. So around here, it's more small hills, and it's a bit flatter, wider, opener landscape than up in the more narrow valleys and up to the mountains.
Okay. Is this where you grew up?
No, I grew up in Gjøvik. It's a small town that's only 20 minutes drive from here.
Okay. Mm. And what made you want to live in the countryside? Like, you know, where I live, it can be, you know, we moved to the country. I'm from the suburbs. I've lived in the city. But many of the young people, like from the older families that have been here for generations, the young people have to move away because there's no jobs in the countryside. Is it similar in Norway? Or
yes, it's very, it's the same story around here. But so when I met my husband, we were students and we both lived in Oslo. Yes, in the capital.
The big city.
Yes, the big city. but he grew up here at the farm. And he is the only child. So when you come from a farm in Norway, the normal thing is to take over the farm after your parents. So when we became a couple, he was he said that, just as you know, I have committed to go back to Biri and stay at the farm. And so that's an important decision to take if you want to be together with me. otherwise, I don't think I would necessarily move back to the countryside.
Okay, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
Now, so you're on his family farm. What do, like, are you producing a certain crop, or do you have livestock, or what are you? What is the family tradition?
We grow. Now my English is. Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, you could try to describe it, and I'll guess.
We have fields where we grow barley and
wheat.
Yes, sometimes
oats.
Yes, oats.
Okay.
Yes, barley and oats. And what do you call that? What's the main word for many?
Grain.
Grain, of course.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yes.
No.
Yeah. So we grow. We have fields with grain, and there is forest, but we don't have we don't have any cows or sheep at this farm.
No. Okay, gotcha.
Mm.
And now you, I think in your YouTube videos, it looks as though you have your own like family cabin or something that's like in a more remote area. Is that, am I getting that right?
Yes, it's not a normal cabin. It's the Summer Mountain Farm that we call Sætre. It's a place where the farmer used to take their animals so they can get enough to eat, like pasture. Just in the summertime. So they send the cows and the sheep and the goats up on the Summer Mountain Farm.
Now, in the winter, are these areas just like totally locked in with snow and ice and whatever?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Is there a bit of a story of how this was part of your family? I mean, they must have been cattle or sheep farmers, right?
Yes. They had cattle. My husband's family, yes. they had. But I think not after around the 60s or something.
Okay.
So
that's on his side of the family?
Yes.
The cabin or the summer home?
Yes, it is.
Farmhouse?
It sort of belongs to the farm.
Okay. And how far is that from Beery?
Well, it is in Beery, actually.
Okay.
But it takes, 30 minutes drive. But in the old days, they they went there.
They walked.
They walked with all the animals. And some people still do, but it's not very, it's not so much anymore in Norway that people have these summer mountains farms.
Really?
The use of it is, some people do, but it's getting less common.
When we stayed in Balestrand, my mom and stepdad love to hike. So we decided to kind of hire a local guide so that we could learn some information. And he took us on a hike, and he was a sheep farmer. And when we were above Balestrand for a few mile hike, we came across one of those, what to me looked like a little cabin. And it was just what you were saying. It was one of these summer farms. And the guy we hired was telling us that back in the day, I guess multiple times a day, I guess a woman would hike up the mountain and collect milk and hike it back down.
Yes. Yes, it's true.
And so is that the, did they have a name? Is that like a milkmaid or something?
Yes.
Or like, what is that
yes,
called?
Yes, it's called okay. Milkmaid or budeie. We call it budeie. So back in the day, as you say, the young girls, they had their summer job was to stay up on the summer mountain farm to take care of the cattle or the goats, or yes, and to milk and to make cheese and yes, take care of the animals.
Very interesting. And you know, I love, so my fiance is an oil painter, and you know, I just love the arts, and I'm an illustrator.
Mm.
And I've seen a lot of those kind of famous, super, like, kind of extremely romantic paintings. I think the artist, yes. I wrote it down here, Dahl?
Yes, yes.
What's his name? Hans? Hans Dahl?
Is it Dahl, maybe? Yeah.
H-A-N-S. I don't know how you guys pronounce that.
Hans, yeah.
Hans Dahl. There's all these famous paintings of like these young, you know, pretty women in their traditional bunad clothing. I think that's what it is.
Yes.
And they're like in the amazing fjords and whatnot.
Mm. Very national romantic, I guess.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It was actually, we in Oslo, we went to your national museum, and they had a whole wing that was kind of like the romantic nationalist
yes.
Paintings by that guy and by I forgot the other guy's names. I'm not gonna be able to think of it now, but well, one thing, so like I said, we love the arts, and when we were in Oslo, we went to the Folk Museum, and one of the things that really was so inspiring to me was a lot of these kind of cabins and houses that were painted, and like the insides were like painted with all these beautiful kind of folk art decorative patterns.
Yes.
And it looks like, yeah. And it looks like in one of your YouTube videos, when you're playing one of the horns or whatnot,
yes.
I guess you're in your husband's family's summer farm, but it's painted.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
Can you tell a little about that?
I guess the video you think about is I sit in front of a bed. And yes. It's a kind of, it's two beds, like, they're bigger than just for one person. Maybe it's for the whole family, kind of. And there is a partial wall, in a way.
A divider?
I don't know the word. I'm sorry, but
that's okay.
It's not walls, but a little bit of it. So it when you lie in the bed, you're a bit tucked in, sort of. It's a
it's almost like a crib for a baby.
Yes, but in grown up size, sort of.
Yeah,
and it's painted. It's painted green, and it has some flower and flower paintings and patterns.
Oh, I love it. And it looks like these kind of folk art was a major part of kind of the rural lifestyle or history. I guess everyone just kind of would, there were certain styles. It just seems very, there was definitely a style that seemed to be across the whole Norwegian countryside. I don't know exactly how it works, but.
Yes, I think you're right.
And do you think that?
Yeah.
Do you think that would have just been painted just by the person that lives there? They're not hiring someone to come do that. It's just by the owner, right?
I think that it depends. On this Saturday, I guess they hired some because where I live at that time when they built this summer mountain farm, it was the local, and now I don't know the word again, local lensmann, the local police.
Okay.
In where you live, they might call it sheriff. And in that time, he was one of the not rich, but you know, had more money than many other people, I guess.
Okay.
In this village or in this on the countryside, so I think he actually used or hired some to paint.
Okay, yeah. He was the past owner of the summer house?
Yes, a couple of generations ago, yes.
Okay, gotcha. Mm. Well, you know, I love all this background. Let's get into some of your music. So you're a professional musician. It seems as though you're like very classically trained or something.
Yes.
Now, how did you get interested in all of these kind of traditional instruments?
Yes. Well, just because of sound, because I can't remember where or when, but I once heard a guy play on this goat horn, bukkehorn, and I really liked the sound of it. When we moved from Oslo, I was thinking of maybe I should get hold of such instruments, and when I did, I didn't know how to play on it, so I just had to learn it myself and I really enjoyed it. So it was just a kind of curiosity. And then I have also interested in nature and history and animals and all this connection that these instruments and the stories and the songs around it tells, sort of. So I guess that's why.
Well, hearing you play it, I mean, that instrument just like makes your hair stand up. Hmm. And I'm definitely going to play a bunch of it throughout this episode. And could you just describe, though, like it had a utilitarian purpose? Like it had it before it was just a beautiful instrument. Like what was, tell a little bit about the history of the Buchelhorn.
Yes. Also the wooden lute and the Buchelhorn, they were instruments used up on the summer mountain farm by the milkmaids or the what do you call them the herders,
the farmer,
the herders,
the herder, okay,
herder, yeah, just to call
the shepherd,
yeah, the shepherd, thank you, to call on the cattle, call on the animals, the goats, but most of all to scare away the predators like wolves and bears. And that's the wooden lure, the long instrument without any holes, no finger holes. You just play the natural tones like you do on a garden hose or something. That has the strongest sound. The Buchelhorn, the goat horn, is a more melancholic instrument. But I guess they also use that to give signals and to scare and to call.
I had no idea about the scaring the predator part.
Aha, yeah. Yeah.
And, interesting.
And it's also used to give signals between people across huge distances. In that time, they didn't have any smartphones or SMS, and so it's a way to communicate.
Okay, it's like the hunting horns.
Yeah, in a way, basically, it's a kind of the same. Yes, it's like calling and scaring, I think, is the most important role, and then also, of course, to entertain themselves. Mm. Often the shepherd or the herder or the milkmaid, they were probably lonely a lot. They were there alone. So they could play for the animals and play for themselves. And yes.
And play for the nature spirits.
Yeah. Yes.
So the Buchelhorn is made from a goat horn.
Yes.
And does the goat have to die? Like, is it once the goat is dead, you cut off the horn?
Yes.
Or, okay, that makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
Now, in one of the coolest parts on your TED Talk was describing how the Buchelhorns were made.
Yeah.
Could you tell a bit about that?
Yeah.
And you can be as graphic as you want, because I do episodes about hunting and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So.
Yes. Well, in the Nordic countries, it's a bit different tradition from, let's say, Sweden and Norway. In Sweden, they mostly used a horn from cow. But here in Norway, we used a horn from the billy goat. And the billy goat can be aggressive and stubborn and, well, only make trouble. So it's not very often farmers let them live long enough to grow big horns, because the horn grow bigger for each year, sort of. You can almost see it on the structure of the horn, how many years the billy goat lived. But when it's time to kill the animal, when it's put down, you can take off the horns. And there is several ways to make it, because it's inside the horn is a kind of marrow. And to make instruments, you have to get the marrow out. So there is several methods to do that. Some people, they like to just take the goat's head, just to chop it off and hang it up on a tree and just let it rotten, and then you can just take the horns off when it's the nature has done its work. Traditionally, I've been told that it's been a method is to lay the horns in urine, also to loosen the marrow from the horns.
Okay.
But I must admit that the method I've used is to boil the horns. Well, also to let it rotten, but I didn't put the goat's head in the tree, only the horns I hanged up in the tree. So when you get when the marrow slips off, it's sort of when it loosens, it just slips off. Then you have to clean it inside and cut and carve and then try to make the holes in the right place. So that's in short how it's done.
Well, I am a hunter, and my fiance has done some kind of like cleaning bones and stuff. So we're familiar with like boiling the skulls and stuff like that to clear off all the meat.
Yeah.
So I see the similar process. Now, regarding the holes, is there a certain number of holes in a traditional bughorn? Is it 3, 4?
Well, it varies a bit.
Okay.
Yes, but the normal is like 4 or 5, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, but it depends a little bit, and it's not always easy to tell before you try if this is going to be a nice instrument or not. So, but I'm not very into the instrument making process, but I've done a little bit of it.
Well, that's cool. You've done it at least one or two times. Yeah. That's still really cool.
Yeah.
And is there a huge difference in the sound between the horns made in Sweden with the cattle and the Norwegian goat horns?
Yes, I think it's a huge difference in the sound, in the tone quality. So I like the Swedish also, but it's different. And it's strange that the tradition is for two different kind of animals, but here we normally used the billy goat. Yes. So
now I'm sure you're aware of this, but in Scandinavia there seems to be like a huge revival with like Viking inspired music. Like such as Wardruna is probably the most famous, but I think they're from Bergen. But there's so many bands like that. And
yes.
Even, have you heard of Myrkur?
Yes, I've heard of it, but not very, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. She's in she's in Denmark. I've actually worked for her in the past, mm-hmm. but she has a whole album with one of those Hans Dahl paintings, I believe. And she also plays traditional instruments. And all of these bands seem to use a lot of those horns.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering, is there an archaeological record of how far back, you know, in Viking times, even further back, were people playing horns like this? You know, I'm very familiar with the Celtic people had the Carnax, which was a huge horn. Do you know anything about like the ancient history of this instrument?
I know not to a certain date, sort of.
Okay.
But it's supposed used back to the Stone Age. It's hard to tell because as I speak a little bit about the in my TEDx talk, it's you know, anywhere in the world where people have animals, they take up a animal horn and they wonder, how can we make music on this? How can we make sounds on this? What happens if I blow on this this horn? So it's hard to tell.
It's quite mysterious and whimsical, and you know, to imagine like the first human being who created a song, you know, that it was probably like that.
Mm.
You know, is probably something so far back of just blowing through something, whether it was like a reed or a horn. Mm. Like, wow. And can you imagine the people sitting around the first person to create a song?
Yeah.
And so the Bukahorn, so you've made your own. So describe what happens when you play them. Have you personally played them for cows and sheep, and how do they react?
Yes. Well, I like to experiment with these instruments in front of animals, because I like to see if they react like I've been told they're supposed to do. Do they come towards me? And yes, they do. And a very nice time was I played on a horn of a billy goat called Kvitragen. It's my largest Bukahorn. It's white, and it's quite rare with white Bukahorns of that size. So I played on it on an outdoor museum in Lillehammer, where this billy goat used to live. And there is an outdoor museum with the old buildings, like you experience in Oslo in the Folk Museum. It's a kind of similar place. So they also have old farming animals, the old breeds of cows and sheep and goats and everything. And I played quite close to the cows, and they came running towards me when I played, and they just stood in a kind of quite close circle around me, and not threatening, sort of. You know, cows are very big animals; they can be a bit scary, but. But these were not. They were just curious. And they stood there listening so closely. And I was thinking, maybe they understand that this is from Kvitragen, who lived there. This sound is something that, of course, that's just my my romantic idea, but it the sound is something that really connects with not only with people but with animals, and I find that really fascinating.
Describe that a little more. What do you mean that they knew? What did they know? They know that it was from that goat or from that region, or what? What do you think? What was your feeling? Be romantic.
My feeling was that they knew that this was a little song that came from their old friend. Some came from Kvitragen, and which horn I played on. But that was just my feeling. Because they had lived there together on the farm, and if it wasn't so, I think there is a kind of connection, and that also between people and animals and the nature and the music, and it's not easy to describe what this force or this power is. But there is a kind of, we call it kraft in Norway, power. Yeah. Something that connects us in a way.
I mean, I totally agree. And it's like, you know, as there's more technology, the technology fixes our little problems, but it seems to strip away the beauty of some of these older ways. Like, you know, now you probably don't need to use the buka horn to corral your livestock, but now the landscape is missing this beautiful addition, this music. Like, you know, with hunting today, there's like GPS collars and whatnot that have like a little beep on them.
Yeah.
So when I'm hunting with my dog, I can push the button, the dog hears a beep, and it comes back to me.
Yes.
Back in the day, hunters were using horns so that everyone who lived in the valley, maybe they found it annoying sometimes, but I'm sure it added a kind of music to the landscape. Hearing these hunting horns echoing through the mountains, there's a beauty that we're now missing. And I just feel that way when I hear you play the buka horn and it makes all my hair stand up. Or in the video, there's a video of you singing in this traditional way in the landscape, and you're like standing on this kind of like super green, kind of mossy looking ground. And I played it for my fiance and she immediately started weeping. And like, I have tears in my eyes too when I hear you sing like that. And to imagine a world where, you know, a little boy might be walking down some rural, like, country road, and to just hear the echoing of like a woman's song through the mountains. I mean, wow. Mm. I mean, how extraordinary and beautiful that must have been.
Mm.
So switching away from the buka horn here to that type of singing that you do, what is that? Is there a name for like that type of singing, and is it the same thing? Is it to corral the livestock? Like, what is that?
Yes. it's the same. It's been used in quite the same way to communicate between the milkmaids from the girl to the shepherd, or to call on the cattle. That's the most, or the goats. That's the most common use of it. So, and it's very efficient. It really does work. So when you sing like that and you have cows around, of course it was easier when you. If I had my own cows, they would know my voice very well, and they would of course come. But when I just test it out, it works. So and horses, I've experienced that horses come and cows come, and because they they of course think that, oh, now I'm getting food. Yeah, I'm going back. She's going to milk me. I need to be milked and all this kind of things.
Is there a name for that type of singing?
We call it huying. Huying. In Sweden, they call it kulning.
Okay.
It's kind of the same, I think. So, yes.
Now, because I don't speak any of these Scandinavian languages, to me, it's just this beautiful sound.
Mm.
Now, are they saying actual things? Like, would they be saying a few words for the milkmaid or the shepherd to hear?
Yeah, often it's oh, it can be a few words, yes, like shouting in a way.
Okay.
To give messages or to ask for something, or just to one girl can ask and the other one can answer, or it's but the most common is to sing out all the names of the animals.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, in the video on your YouTube, what are you saying? What is the translation?
I'm not sure which. Well,
okay.
I think it's maybe. If I think of the right video, I think it's a combination of just huying, which I just sing high-pitched, like to, without words.
Oh, okay.
And then it could be a song.
Okay, okay, more, right. So it'd be like saying like, ooh.
Yeah, yeah.
Or like, hee-ya, yeah, something like
yes.
that. Okay, okay. That's so interesting. I had no idea that they were actually saying like a message.
Well, it can be, yes. It can be.
And, very interesting.
And it's also the milkmaids that did that in the old days. Some of them were really, really good singers. Because when you hear, it's not very much old recordings of it, but it's some. And they are virtuose. What do you call that in English? They're very, very advanced musically.
Okay.
So yeah, but that of course depends. But it's I think it's sometimes it's a practical use just to give messages, to call on the cattle, and other times it's more like
music.
Yes.
Okay, okay. Now, are you one of the only professional musicians that knows how to do the buka horn and this type of singing?
Well, this type of singing is in Norway, many other singers okay. that can do. I don't know how many. Not. It's not very common, but it's there are some very good singers, folk singers, that does that.
Okay.
I'm. But on the instruments, there's a handful or two people that plays on a professional level, I guess.
For the buka horns?
Yes, but I think it's It's gotten more popular the last years. So okay. Maybe it's more now. I'm not sure.
Have you considered doing an album of the rural singing?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
I just recorded a couple of just a few songs. Yes. So.
Well, your Bukahorn album is absolutely. It makes your hair stand up. It's just so beautiful.
Thank you. I wasn't planned to make that little album because. But I was asked to record for a game like Civilization, you know.
It's, yes.
Yeah. What do you call that? Those kind of games.
I'm not sure. I don't play any of that stuff.
No, but it was I was recorded for like this game. And then I thought, well, now I have some samples, so yeah.
Yes, I've actually, when I saw that on your website, I was, you know, I was kind of excited because I actually have, you know, trying to find like old horn music and like some of the Celtic Karnaks. I did find the soundtrack from that video game, and I have it in some of my playlists. So to learn that some of your work has been on that same soundtrack is really, really cool.
Uh-huh.
And so the Bukahorn is just one of the horns that you play. What are some of the other ones?
Well, if we should stay here speaking about the animals and the summer farm, so mm-hmm. I have to mm-hmm. mention the wooden lute. It has the same purpose, sort of, to scare and to call. And that, but that is this. If you've seen one of my videos where I play this long wooden instrument, it's played in the same way, sort of. It's like you play on a horn or a trumpet or a brass instrument. It's but it's in wood. Only wood and no okay. holes.
Okay.
And made of spruce. Do you know spruce? Not the pine.
Yes.
Not the pine, but the other the Christmas tree.
mm-hmm,
yes.
Mm-hmm.
And outside it's the birch bark that's swirled around outside.
Okay. Now, is there a purpose to wrapping it in the other bark? Is that just for to look cool, or does that actually change the sound?
I'm not sure, actually. Maybe it's okay. just to preserve it better, or
okay,
you know, it's the wooden lutes. They're also used far back, but naturally they. They doesn't live for so long. They
deteriorate. They decay.
Yeah.
They rot.
Yes. Yes.
Because it's a piece of wood.
Yes. Yes. So, but in old excavations, there is archaeological findings in Norway from around 850, I think. In Denmark, there is a finding from around year 400, and so from the Iron Age, and it's also it's kind of cool. You know, the Bukahorns, because of it's a horn from the goat. It's a lot of people who likes to romanticize the dark powers, you know, the the devil and so on.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
That combines this. They contact me to, oh, where do I get these horns? You know, and I've read that the wooden lure in the we had witch processes in Norway around 1600, 1660. In Finnmark, the most northern part, it is said that the witches, they danced with devils and they played on lures.
Okay.
So, and in the medieval age, it was used like a war instrument and to gather people for meetings and so on. So it's the same use. It's a communication tool.
Okay, so you were saying the witch trials in Norway, like they had in Iceland and like they had across other parts of Europe.
Yes.
Now, on your album with the Bukahorn, are all of those songs, like traditional folk songs, are some of them your own inventions? And if any of those are like the old folk songs, is there anything historical that you know about them or anything interesting?
On this this little album?
The Bukahorn on your Bukahorn.
Yes. This is a little bit embarrassing because I don't remember which I have there. No, I can have a quick look. Okay. I think I have a couple of my own. And then the other ones is like local traditional music.
Really? From where you are?
Yes, from where I live.
Well, how did you learn it? Are there old recordings or did you actually go around and try to learn it from other people?
No, I have some I know some people who know these old music, but it's also I have some written sources on those.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Well, that is so cool. I love the idea of preserving these old songs.
Yes, and the fun thing is that so many people, when they are gaming, they sit and listen to this while they game. And I think it's so cool that these local old traditional tunes played on Bukahorn is out there. It's fun.
I mean, I love that. I love that. Now let's talk about how this horn kind of got you this kind of huge opportunity. So your TED Talk is all about how, I'll let you say it. Talk about how, you know, here you are playing these songs in this little place in Norway, and all of a sudden you had this huge, huge, huge opportunity in film.
Yes. I suddenly got an email from Hollywood that said that they were working on a film that required Bukahorn, and they had found me on YouTube and fell in love with my playing, and that was my way into Disney's Frozen. So when an composer in Hollywood requires Bukahorn. it's not very common, and I think that's because they wanted his assistant wanted really to get a real Norwegian touch on the music. So he was searching through a lot of music and musicians and wanted to find something really, really old and authentic. And that was kind of fun.
Well, I give them a lot of credit for not just finding an American that could half-ass it, but really trying to get the sound right and reaching out to the place. You said that they sent a producer all the way to Oslo to record with you.
Yes, they did.
Like that, I give them a lot of credit for that.
me too. I think that was, it describes how serious they really work. And I really do appreciate it. And I also know that the producers and the art director and all of them, they really have fallen in love with Norway. So when they are doing their, what do you call film number two, sequel?
The sequel, yes.
Sequel. And number three and four. I guess they're coming back to find more Norwegian details and go into the culture and the nature and Aurora Borealis, you know, the northern lights they use a lot.
Yep, Orion.
And of course, I've traveled a lot, and it's not something we think of every day when we live in this country, but I know that we have a lot of wild nature. We have a clean air and these northern lights, and it must be a fairy tale for many people to come and to visit, or to experience it, because it's so different, and we have a lot of countryside and untouched nature still.
It's definitely a pretty stupendous place. I mean, when you read like how people describe old poetry and old paintings, they're always talking about this word that we have in English called the sublime.
Mm-hmm.
And excuse me, I need to clear my throat. And the sublime basically means like a supreme beauty, like an awe, like you know, a beauty of incredible awe. And I've always read that word, but I've never really had an experience where I felt what these artists and painters or musicians were always referring to as the sublime until in Norway. And we went on a hike in the Arlandsfjord across from Flam. We went on this hike, and they actually have like a lookout platform that looks out at the fjord. And I think the rock cliffs are like 1,000 feet above. And then over the top of those mountains, there are like glaciers. And the light was very like diffused looking, like the light was almost kind of like foggy looking.
Yes.
But the second I saw this, the second I looked out at this landscape, I mean, my hair stood up. And my mom, my mom is not very woo-woo, you know, she worked in computers and stuff like that.
Yes.
She immediately started crying and was just saying, it's just it was the sublime. It was being overwhelmed by the beauty of nature.
Yes.
And to me, I felt like, you know, you guys have in your old Nordic mythology, you have all these stories of giants and trolls, and I could actually see it. Like I could see where your mythology came from.
Yes.
Because as we were up on the rocks looking out at this fjord, I could actually see that a giant could easily emerge from the horizon and jump from one side of the fjord over to the next cliff and keep on walking by.
Yeah.
And that would almost be normal.
Yes.
Like you could feel the mythology in the landscape.
Mm.
And so I don't know why I just went on that tangent, but
yes, but I understand. It's you told me if I had any magical stories, and I've been really thinking about it, but I think my closest magical experiences has been with strong nature experiences, if you know what I mean. It's when the northern light, or just when the light changes, the color changes, when you hear the birds and all this, being very close to the nature, in the nature.
Now, when you talk about this like magic, I'm going to try to like further articulate what I was saying about having the buca horn or the traditional singing on the landscape. So I believe in like ghosts, but I've got a lot of friends who really believe in stuff like fairies or nature spirits.
Yes.
And I've certainly had a lot of weird experiences in nature where it felt very, the whole landscape felt alive. It felt surreal. It felt magical. And it felt like there were spirits around or a spirit. But, you know, even when I did my episode with the woman in Iceland who is the manager of the Museum of Sorcery, we talked a little bit about how in Iceland they believe in elves, or at least they used to. And I'm sure in Norway too, and you know, in Scotland and all over the world, the belief in little people and nature spirits, elves. And to me, even though I don't really know how I feel if those things are quite real or not, but when I hear you play those instruments, to me it's like the landscape is happy, or maybe the nature spirits are happy. Like it seems so connected to the folklore or the spirits. I mean, do you have any feelings like that or any thoughts on that?
Oh, I think it was, I like to hear it. well, I'm not, I understand the feeling of the mythic and the magical stuff when you're out and you feel that the nature is it is more than what we can see. And you also talk about the elves, the mythic people from another world, sort of. And of course, it's many of the old tunes or calls or songs, they are also have this theme. And the text can be about, or the title can be about Huldra. But I think also maybe this all these stories and songs about Huldra and Huldrefolket, the elves, sort of, the Huldras, the kin, can you say that? The kin of Huldra, her family. But we don't use the word elves in Norway. But it's a kind of something similar, I think. That it could be also an old-fashioned way to warn children not to do this or that, to stay safe, to be alert or whatever. So these old stories and songs could have also a role in the upbringing to warn. But so the songs is the Huldre songs is usually telling these stories, but Huldre Lok, the calls, are more in the way Huldra herself singing her calling on her cattle. Most of the music was also used to tell people to take good care of the animals so you don't upset Huldra. You don't upset the elves, because they are always on the animal's side, you know. I've played for audiences consisting of hunters and foresters, and then I talk about the calling and the scaring, and I play, and I also speak about the forest nymph, Huldra. And Huldra, she's supposed to be a woman-like figure that sort of captivates men and tricks them to get over to her side in a way. She sort of casts a spell on them. She's often described as a beautiful woman with a tail coming out under her skirt. She's courageous and strong. So I guess she has been an inspiration for women and maybe a threat to men, because she's supposed to bewitch and lure men to join her into the underground world to marry her and get children together and so on. So there is a lot of tales and songs and calls that is supposed to be coming from Huldra. And Huldre calls, Huldre lock, it can be almost similar to the huying, which we talked about, the high-pitched singing in a way. And when I have performed for these hunters and foresters, afterwards, I've several times got the stories from them about their own meetings with what sounds like Huldra. When they are alone in the forest, and someone has said that they have seen a woman a little bit far away, or they have heard something like singing, or so this is myths or experiences that people around have in their lives.
There was once a hunter who had gone up in the hills to shoot wild fowl. He came into a forest and walked along, staring up at the treetops looking for birds. Before he knew it, he found himself inside a place he had never seen before. It was a big farm, and there were so many houses with long verandas on all sides that there was no end to them. He wandered aimlessly about until at last he grew tired of it. He did not see any people, and he could not find the way out. Finally, he thought he heard someone inside one of the houses. He opened the door and looked in, and there sat a girl, quite alone. He spoke to her and asked what kind of people were living on the farm. She said that Tusa folk lived there, and it was the kind of farm that no one could see before he was inside, and from it no one could ever come out again. This is what happened to her. She had been there for a long time, and she did not know how to get home again. The hunter grew frightened and asked again if she was certain she knew no way out. She said she could indeed give him advice, but then he would have to promise to come back and take her away from this farm. This he promised to do. "Now follow me," she said, "and open the door I point out to you. In there, they are sitting around the table eating. The one sitting at the head of the table is their king. He's bigger and handsomer than the rest, and you'll know him as soon as you look inside the room. Then you're to take your gun and aim it at the king, but you mustn't shoot. They'll be afraid and chase you out, but they won't dare to harm you, for you have the gun. Then you're saved, and then you must think of me. You're to come back here on the first Thursday evening and the second and the third Thursday evening too, and then it's certain that I'll go home with you." Then she went out and showed him the door he was to open. He went inside, and there they sat around the table eating and drinking. He took the gun and aimed it at the one who was sitting at the head of the table. Then they grew frightened and jumped up at him, and he got away. They chased him all the way out, and in this way he got away from them and came safely home. He went up there to the hill on the first Thursday evening after that, and on the second Thursday too, and talked with the girl both times. But on the third Thursday evening, which was the most important, he did not come. Whatever it was that hindered him, I've never found out. Then it happened once that the hunter was up on the hill again. It was at least 3 or 4 years later. Then he heard someone crying and carrying on badly and complaining about how sad and unpleasant it was to have to stay there by herself all the time and not to be able to come home. He stayed there for a long time, looking and searching in every direction, but he was not able to find anything except marsh and forest, which is all that there is up there.
I also remember one time some years ago, I had a gig where the end of my performance was to call up on stage a well-known man in Norway, Lars Monsen. He's an explorer, been out alone hiking with his dogs for months. And when I called him up on stage, you know, he's in a way a prototype of a tough man. This explorer alone out in the wilderness, and he was going to talk about bears and hiking across Canada, I think, but got so inspired of what I was speaking about, the calling and the scaring and huldra and so on. So then he started to talk about his experiences with a magical nature. And he also strongly believes there is more out there than we can explain.
Wow. And see, I just love hearing things like that because I think there's some truth to it. And I think certain instruments will connect to those unseeable aspects of the world, the natural world, and some won't. Like, I don't think if you played electric guitar to the landscape that you might have as, it might evoke the same feeling.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's something to the type of instrument and the sound and the history of it. I think all of it matters. All the little details matter. Mm. Do you know any more? Is there any more like regional folklore like that that you know about?
What you think you like about the elves or the mythic people?
Anything.
Or, yes.
Anything from where you live.
Yes. Well, there is, of course, there's a lot of stories, but there are many of these old stories is about this connection to the outly world people, sort of, or this mythic, this elves in some way, of what people can do or not do. To not upset them, there is you asked me about the Bukkehorn album, and I there is a song on it called Til Til Tove. And the text for that is about it's a call for Tove, which is a farmer, the girl's employer down at the farm, and she's calling on him and saying that there is 12 men. There are 12 men in the forest with 12 swords. They are killing. She's up on the Summer Mountain Farm when she sings this or calls this. But I just play it on this album. The 12 men in the forest with 12 swords. They are killing my best cow. They are killing the bull. They're beating up the small children. I guess that was the shepherds. And they say they want to kidnap me into the high mountains and rape me. So I guess she called for help with that song and made the men in the village come to rescue her. And that kind of songs and texts is many variations on.
Wow, interesting. So that seems like in Appalachian music and in like Scotland and England, there's a lot of these like murder ballads, mm-hmm. which is like a genre of song about, you know, often quite similar things. So yeah. That's kind of interesting. Yeah.
I think it's
very interesting.
And of course, on the wooden lure, this long wooden instrument that I also play, there is an old tale from Gudbrandsdalen. It's not far from here, about Prillarguri. And I guess you've seen when you spoke about the paintings at the Romantic National Romantic Museum. She is a very known mythical figure. But some people, there is, it's an old tale. Some of it is true, some of it we don't know. But she has become the most famous lute and bukkehorn player in Norway. And there is different opinions of which of those instruments she actually played, because she's supposed to be the one that gave signals to the local men in the battle of Kringen in 1612, I think. There was a Scottish army that came to, they were soldiers for the Swedish king, like mercenaries.
Yep, mercenaries. Yes.
For the Swedish king, yes, which was at war with the Danish-Norwegian king. I think that was kind of that. And the Scottish came from the west coast, across the mountains and to the area which I live in, a little bit further north, and ended up in the valley, Gudbrandsdalen. And Prillarguri, the woman, she has an important role in this story because she played signals from a hill to warn the farmers down in the valley and to get the guys ready to go for an attack. The farmers killed the Scottish mercenaries very violently, says the story, because of her signals.
Wow, so they got him out of the country. They pushed him out, slaughtered him. Well, I think we've had a great conversation. Thank you for, I know this must be pretty difficult to do a whole podcast in a second language or your third language.
Yes, and I'm so sorry. I'm just stumbling away.
No. That's to be expected.
Yeah.
Well, one thing I really like about, traveling is trying different foods. And on my other episodes about with Scandinavian guests, I just kind of mentioned some things that we tried while we were in Norway that are definitely unique.
Yeah.
One of which were like the cheeses of Norway. And we had one that was really crazy called Gammelost.
Yes.
And it's from a little town called Vik, which we actually went to. We went to one of the stave churches there.
Yes.
But I read that this cheese is literally like just from that area. And other people call it Viking cheese because it's so intense and it smells and tastes like animals. Like it tastes like the wool or the fur of a barnyard animal. It's very intense.
Yes, it's intense. That's right.
And because you were talking in the beginning about some of the milkmaids back in history and how they would have been making the cheeses, are there any like special cheeses from your area or just what is there a certain kind of cheese that the milkmaids of Norway would have been making? Like, is there anything like that we could kind of finish up on?
Well, there is a lot of special Norwegian cheese, I guess. But the brown cheese is from not very far from here. It's from Prillarguri's area in Gudbrandsdalen, and that's a kind of opposite of the gammelost, the old cheese. It's very sweet. And it's...
Is it called... It's Brunost?
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. Okay.
So that I suppose the girls on the farm, the milkmaids, made Brunost also. They could do that.
I was going to say, when we got home, we watched a video on how the Brunost is made. And it seems that some part of the cooking process, the sugars kind of burn and caramelize to create that kind of sweet flavors and that brown color.
Mm. Yeah. And it's, I think that's a very typical Norwegian cheese.
And yeah, we don't have anything like that here in America, that sweet cheese. It's almost kind of like maple syrup. It tastes like cheese with a little bit of maple syrup in it or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And I could mention that where I live, Biri, the old meaning of the word, it comes from birid, which is means the bear cave. Is that where
really?
You know in the winter time the bear goes into? Is it called a bear cave?
They go to hibernate in a cave.
Yeah. Bears hiding,
that
sort of.
That is cool.
Yeah, but I've never seen a bear here. but we have lynx that goes through the the countryside here once in a while, and our neighbor that have sheep had lost several sheep to the lynx, so.
Wow.
So it is wild, the wildlife is here. we are very close to the wildlife.
We have bobcats here, but I don't think a bobcat, I don't think that they would take down a sheep. I think a lynx must be quite a bit larger.
Yes, I think it's larger than bobcat, yes.
Now, I did an episode with a bear hunter over in Sweden where they still have bears. Are there still bears and wolves in Norway?
Yes.
Maybe all
but,
the way
but
north.
But not many. But, I'm okay. Not sure how many there is. But there is, yes. Both bears and wolves and lynx and what do you call it? Wolverine.
Wolverine.
Yeah.
Oh, awesome. I love all those guys.
Yeah. And we have badger in the barn.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So.
Okay. I just remembered my final question.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you tell a little bit about bunad? That is the traditional like clothing of country people, or was it for special occasions? Because I think I saw a video where you're wearing the bunad. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What is it?
The bunad is based on traditional clothing from, I think, 1700 and 1800, usually it's made of wool. It's different from which part of the country you're from. Each valley or part of the country has its own patterns and colors and...
It's highly decorated and
yes.
Covered in kind of like designs and floral patterns. And
yes.
It's just so beautiful.
And
now, do you have your
yes,
own? Do you have your
yes,
own?
Yes, I have my own. It's quite common that the girls, when they are around 15, when we have this ceremony that we call it confirmation. What's it called? Confirmation.
Yeah.
It's quite common that the girls get it to the confirmation. It's usually white shirts and it's a dress sort of made in wool, and it's different patterns and often a lot of embroideries or colors, and also quite a lot of silver on it. So the silver buttons and silver
jewelry.
Yes, jewelry from the old times. It was to scare away the bad things, the bad elves and so on.
Really?
What do you call it? The bad spirits. Yes. Yes.
Really.
So it's a lot of folklore and this old faith that's into this national costumes.
Now, today, are there only certain days of the year where it's like kind of a national thing to do?
We also the national day, 17th of May. You can see a lot of people out in the streets in this. National costumes, and it's also common to use it in weddings and
okay,
yeah,
it's incredibly beautiful.
Yeah, it's nice.
And is it called Bunad for the men as well?
Yes, it is. It is.
Okay, so that word just means the traditional clothing.
Yes, yes, it is.
Okay, well, and what colors are yours?
Mine is dark blue, very, very dark, almost black, the skirt, and then it has an embroidery on the breast that's in different colors, red and yellow and green and white. And I have...
And it's from where? Which region is your
design? It's from the western part where my father came from.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
So my father came from a little place north of Bergen, and my mother, she comes from Finnmark, up in Vardø, close to the Russian border, not the Russian border, but it's the most eastern city in Norway, up high up in the north. So my blood is from the coast, but I have grown up here in the inland.